Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:05 p.m. on Wednesday, March 28, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Christie Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Ben from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to thank committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, Representative Ledoux, Representative Stutz, my vice chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 75, Gun Violence Protective Order, sponsored by Representative Tarr. This is the seventh hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Today, to provide a brief recap, on Monday we adopted the committee substitute, House Bill 75, version R, heard public testimony and took questions. At this time, I'd like to allow representatives from the Alaska State Troopers to answer questions and provide testimony. We have, I believe, online from the State Troopers and the Department of Public Safety related to VPSOs, we have Captain Dan Loudon from the State Troopers, Sergeant Matthew Hightower, also from the Alaska State Troopers, and Captain Andrew Merrill from the Department of Safety VPSOs. I would just make a note that if you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not clear, and it makes it hard for us to hear. I'll also note that it is my intention to take up House Bill 9 or Senate Bill 93 and House Bill 367 later today, so we're going to keep committee questions limited to probably 15 minutes. But before we get to that, I've got a series of questions that I'll inquire of the troopers, and then after that we'll allow some follow-up from the committee. And I believe, Captain Loudon, you're probably the starting one to ask, and if this isn't a good question for you to answer, then you should defer either to Sergeant Hightower or to Captain Merrill. And the first query in terms of standard procedure for troopers and VPSOs, is there a difference in how they serve domestic violence protective orders today, and what is the general practice for the Department of Public Safety for serving domestic violence protective orders today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Captain Dan Loudon with the State Troopers. The folks that I have on the line for introduction are Sergeant Hightower, as you said, from Fairbanks. He's a shift supervisor and did some training with our VAWA coordinator on domestic violence protective order serving. And Captain Merrill is the commander of the VPSO program. So those particular areas will be their expertise for these type of questions. So I think this first question probably is best answered by Sergeant Hightower.
Yes, sir. I presume, Clayton, for the record, this is Sergeant Matthew Hightower. As far as the service of the domestic violence protective orders and those, as far as how we serve them, there's no difference between how an Alaska State Trooper or a Village Public Safety Officer will serve them. We will receive them, make sure they are entered into the computer, into APSIN, as well as our RMS system, and go to and serve the respondent with very little delay or no delay if possible.
And do you typically send one trooper or VPSO to serve a domestic violence protective order, or is it a team of two typically?
Sir, it will depend on who we are serving, if we have any prior knowledge of any officer safety concerns. Typically, it is served by either one state trooper, court service officer, or VPSO. But if it is through prior knowledge, through officer safety issues, we may choose to go with more than one or more than two, depending on the situation.
Is there a difference between rural settings and urban settings in terms of the standard practice of the troopers?
No, not particularly. It takes a little bit more time in a rural setting. Typically, unless we get the protective order in the same day, and if there's no VPSO in the village, it may be delayed by us getting out through airfare or weather delays and stuff like that.
And what about the potential that a respondent for a domestic violence protection order has a firearm or may have a firearm? How does the firearm topic impact practices with regard to domestic violence protective orders?
As far as if we know there's a, just for clarification, just if there's a weapon in the house or if there was one used in the commission of the offense or alleged offense.
Do you assume that everyone you're serving a domestic violence protective order probably has a gun in the house?
Yes, sir, we do.
Okay. And based on your understanding of the House Bill 75, how would a gun violence protective order, under your understanding of the bill, compare to a domestic violence protective order in serving those orders?
Based on my understanding of the order, I don't believe there will be any difference other than what we serve to them and what we would be required by law to take from them that, as far as that point, whatever the judge or magistrate says we need to take.
Okay. I'm not sure that either one answered the next question, but what is the frequency of troopers and VPSOs being involved in serving domestic violence protective orders currently?
Sorry, I defer to Captain Loudon on that one.
Captain Loudon.
Mr. Chair, for the record, this is Captain Loudon with the troopers. In 2017, the troopers served 1,360 domestic violence orders. We had received a total of 1,937. The difference in that number is such that, depending on when we run these things, we might have received an order but had not yet served it, or it was recalled, or that sort of thing. And then for stocking orders, we had served 265, and we had received an additional 66 for a total of 334 stocking orders received in 2017.
Thank you. And what is the part of the HB 75 would involve the seizure of guns? What is the Department of Public Safety policy regarding weapons storage?
Through the chair, this is Captain Loudon again. We would, whenever we would take a weapon into our custody, we would run that serial number through the computer databases for the state and national to see if it was stolen. We would record all the information that we could about identifying that weapon, the make, the model, the caliber, the barrel length, serial number, those sorts of things. Under the right circumstances, if a person is there and we're aware of who the owner is, we'd probably give them a receipt for that weapon that we had it in our custody, but not all the time. And then we would return to the office with that weapon. We would package it up. We have specially designed boxes for storing firearms in our evidence room. We would enter that weapon into our RMS system and list it with the associated incident number, get it into the evidence locker where it'd be placed there for storage.
And what is your understanding of whether the state troopers have the capacity, if this bill becomes law, to manage the weapons storage that may be required under gun violence protection orders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The trouble that I think we have in pinning that down to a real definitive answer is we're going into new territory. We don't know how many to expect. We are at capacity in many of our rural evidence lockers. I've had different commanders tell me they are doing alternate storage things for items that we already have, In Bethel, for example, I understand they're using one of the holding cells to store firearms in. So it probably will not take very many weapons for us to be looking at some sort of alternative storage capacity for handling these.
And I take it that would depend on whether there were 500 of these orders in a year or five of these orders statewide in a year. If there were 500, that would create a different management problem than if there were only five.
Correct, Mr. Chair. It's based on the number of the orders that we have and then the number of weapons that that particular individual may or may not possess. There are probably many folks in Alaska who have dozens, maybe even scores of weapons.
And do the provisions that would allow custody of the weapons by a third party that's approved by the court rather than being held by a police agency, would that potentially provide some relief for the storage issues that you, or I guess the potential storage issues that you just addressed?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think that's a possibility to assist with. The thing that I see there that would be difficult is the ability of a person to obtain court-approved third party within the 48 hours or the instantaneous under the ex parte idea of us seizing the weapons. So in those two time frames, it might be difficult for a person to get that court approval. So we would probably have to take them into our custody, but it would still be helpful if, you know, within a week or 2 weeks, such a third party could come forward and we would have the legal ability to release the weapons to them.
Okay. And then the last area of questions I had is whether the troopers or the VPSOs are involved from time to time in the warrantless seizure of weapons from individuals.
Through the chair again, this is Captain Loudon. Yes, we seize weapons without a warrant. Under several conditions, there are exigent circumstances to the search warrant rules. There are other exemptions. For example, if the weapon is in plain sight, we contact someone in their living room and it's sitting there on the coffee table. I don't see many of these anymore, but people used to have gun racks in their pickup truck. If there was a rifle or a shotgun on one of those gun racks and we could cleanly see it, we seize weapons in that way. We might have a Terry-type type of contact where we've done a pat-down search and we'd find a weapon. The current statutes require a person to who's carrying concealed to notify the police officer when they're contacted that they have a weapon and to allow the police officer to secure it if they so desired during the contact. In that type of situation, unless something arose where we arrested the person or we became concerned through this bill that we would not be given the weapon back. Normally, on your routine contacts, we would probably give that weapon right back to the person at the scene. But there are several ways that we end up with weapons in our possession without a warrant.
Thank you. Those are the questions that I have. So I'm going to allow folks to have an opportunity to ask questions from the committee. I'd note because we're planning to take up two other bills today, we're going to limit committee questions to 15 minutes. And I'm going to ask folks to limit your questions to 1 minute, and I'm going to give each committee member three questions and then move on to the next person to inquire. Does anyone have questions for folks? Representative Eastman.
Yes, through the chair. So I'm curious, if you encounter an individual who has a weapon and you don't believe that it would be advisable for them to continue to have that weapon, but they haven't committed any crimes yet, what authority or what justification can you use to secure that weapon and then, you know, keep it for a period of time after you've made contact with the individual and the call is over?
Representative Eastman, through the chair. This is Captain Loudon with the troopers. There is not a lot of statute authority that I'm aware of to keep weapons under the situation that you described very narrowly. If we were concerned about that person's well-being to the point that we did a Title 47 commitment, and had them sent in for a 72-hour observation, the situation might be such that where we had contact with that person, we would need to take the weapon for safekeeping because there's no one there to hand it off to, that sort of thing. But to simply seize it, if there's no crime, there's no other reason, there's not a lot of authority that I'm aware of to do that.
Thank you.
Follow-up? Any other questions, Representative Reinbold?
So thank you for being here today. A couple things that you said just caused me a little bit of pause. One thing was it says sometimes you give receipts for guns, and sometimes when you take them, you don't give receipts. One, I'm wondering in what cases do you give them and what cases do you give them back? And also with the same frame, has it been difficult getting guns back to the owners once you seize them, or what do you do with them?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, again, Captain Loudon with the troopers. The receipt that we would give folks or not would be situationally dependent. And at some point, we would give someone a receipt, most likely. So we might have a situation where we've arrested a person and we are taking them into custody, and then we're also taking the weapon. We are usually by ourselves or with one other trooper, so we would likely take them to have them booked into the jail and process and whatnot. So it might take a while for them to get a receipt. If we're doing a search warrant, for example, on the house, we are required to leave a receipt for all the things that we take when we leave. So it's situationally dependent. It's not a question of choosing not to give someone a receipt at all. It's just the circumstances.
Follow up?
Okay, so I guess that just causes some people a pause, you know, in regards to it's situationally dependent. If you take something, especially a gun or a firearm or something that may be of treasure to individuals, you know, in some cases you give receipts and when some cases you not. So I do think that is something, you know, that needs to be discussed, especially if in cases with this bill where you're doing it without a warrant. And you said with a warrant you have to leave information of what you've taken, but I do think there appears to be a loophole in there. And also another question I have is, of course, everybody wants public safety and nobody wants guns to get into the wrong hands, but I believe that you, as well as I, swear to uphold and defend the Constitution, and the Constitution clearly states, you know, that people have the right to bear arms. So I guess I'm trying to figure out where, in your opinion, you think it's okay to confiscate those guns, even if you've had sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution. I just think that question continues to be put on us on Facebook and our emails, you know, in person, and that's really where.
Representative Wright, that's a good question. You've used your minute. I think you can answer the question.
Sorry, Captain Loudon. I'm not sure I heard Representative Clayman's comments.
I just said that she asked you the question about how do you square your, well, she's asking a question about the Second Amendment rights and how you address that when you make a decision to seize weapons.
Okay. Representative Reinbold, through the chair, the constitutionality of any law that we work with is usually decided by the courts and by direction that we receive through the Attorney General's office. And at this particular time, I'm not in a position to tell you what the those opinions might be regarding this this particular bill. I know the Department of Law has looked at it.
I think her question was broader, not specific to this bill, but broadly related to seizures in general when you make a warrantless seizure of a firearm.
And Mr. Chairman, and to clarify, do you take an oath to defend and uphold the Constitution?
He does take an oath to defend and uphold the Constitution. He can answer the question about seizing firearms without a warrant.
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, as I described earlier, there are exceptions to the search warrant requirement, and in those circumstances, those would be the types of situations where we might take a weapon from someone when we don't have a search warrant. If it's on their person when we arrest them and we search them and we find it, we might take it. If it's in plain view, where we can see it, we are allowed to seize it there.
Representative Reinbold, last question.
We'll go ahead and let Ledoux do the next.
Actually, Representative Kopp is next in queue.
Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Chairman. Captain Loudon, could you explain to the committee the process of, under any circumstance, when you take a firearm, when you enter it into for safekeeping or as evidence, just the forms that you use and whether they're in triplicate and your ability to, whether or not you can always get a receipt back to someone after the fact? Can you talk to us about that?
For the record, Captain Loudon with the Troopers, Representative Kopp through the chair. It's been a long time since I worked the street, and we now have a computer RMS, so I'll do the best that I can to answer that. In my day, we had physical paper forms with carbon paper in them, and that's what we would use to document it. Now we have computer systems, and some, if not most, of the troopers, is my understanding, have printers in their cars so they can print things off. But there are many troopers, especially in rural Alaska, that don't have the instant access to that sort of portable technology where they'd be able to print off the form to use as a receipt at that moment. The data would be entered in through the computer, the serial number, make, model, barrel length, so forth. That goes into the system, and then the paper is just copied at that point for either the person to be used as a receipt or any number of people that we would give a copy to. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you, follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Captain Loudon. In the rural areas of Alaska where technology is more limited for support, are those areas more likely to have the older property forms that have the barrel length, the serial number, the caliber, all those identifying blocks on those property forms that you can just fill out in pen, or are you saying that you've kind of done away with those entirely now?
Representative Kopp through the chair, I don't know if the folks in rural Alaska are using paper as a backup, and I don't want to put him on the spot, but I'll offer up that Captain Merrill, through his work with VPSO program, might be aware of what troopers in those areas are doing, and hopefully he can give a better answer than I could.
Captain Merrill?
Representative Kopp, through the chair. This is Captain Merrill for the record. So what we're doing currently with VPSOs and troopers in Western Alaska is they have access typically to the records management system, which is electronic, and that information is input directly to the system. And so for receipts, I don't know, it just depends, I guess, on the availability. If an officer that's on a scene, VPSO or a trooper, and they see the firearm, it depends on the circumstances as to whether or not they're going to have access to any hard copy forms. I'm not aware of troopers carrying around hard copy either triplicate forms or other forms that they give. A lot of times it's simply a note in their notebook. They annotate the property they've seized, and then some of them will rip a notebook page out, have the individual sign it, and the trooper will sign it saying they've taken their property. So it depends on the availability of computers, of paper, and where exactly, time of day and night. So there's a lot of variables that will impact how a receipt is given, but I'm not aware of any troopers or DPSOs carrying forms around they hand out if they've seized property, specifically firearms.
Representative Cobb, it sounds like there's terrific good forms may be in a museum somewhere.
We've entered the modern age. Yeah.
Further follow-up?
For Captain Loudon, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Last one.
Yeah, Captain Loudon, for warrantless seizure of firearms, can you talk to the committee about circumstances where troopers may respond to a residence or a business where a crime has not been committed, but where you encounter a very angry or upset in possession or under their immediate control a firearm, where you might take it for safekeeping until that situation is at least stabilized? Can you talk through the committee how that works?
Representative Kopp, through the chair again, this is Captain Loudon. So if we were to receive a call, either someone threatening to harm themselves, or they're just distraught or seemingly upset, and they have a weapon, yes, there are situations where we would take that weapon for safekeeping, for the safety of everyone currently. I don't think we do that very often. We try to keep this to a minimum. We would look for maybe a family member or some other way, but if that's what we had to do to make everyone safe, that's probably what we would do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux.
So what would you do right now if somebody wrote on Facebook, "I'm really mad at the world. I think I'm going to go into a school and start shooting people"? Would you take that person into custody? Would you seize that person's guns? Would you go for an involuntary commitment? What, if anything, would you do now? Or could you do?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, for the record, Captain Loudon. Again, it's been a long time since I've worked the street, but these are the steps that I would probably take in that sort of a situation. I would do the best, if someone reported this to me, because I want to make clear that troopers are not out there monitoring people's Facebook pages at random. But if someone brought that to our attention, I'd like to think that the troopers would make an effort to contact this person to determine what is going on. And through that contact, by interviewing them, interviewing potentially their family and so forth, to understand what was going on with that post and why they made it and so forth. If the situation were such right now today that we believe that someone is a danger to themselves or others, and that they might be suffering from some mental difficulties, we would do what is called a Title 47 commitment and have that person taken to a facility, usually API. I think Bartlett does it there in Juneau, and have that person evaluate it. Whether we took the weapons, if we did that at that point, would all depend on the circumstances and the situation. Again, if there is no one there to take custody of them, we would probably do so. If this is a situation where the person's living with other family members, and they are able to convince us that they can properly secure them and keep them away from the person, we very well might leave them there with that person. Or they might say, hey, could you let my grandfather who lives, you know, across town take them? We'd look at all those sorts of options. But the first thing we'd have to do is find the person and try to figure out what's really going on there.
Follow up?
So, what would you do if the guy, I mean, not all people who shoot other people are necessarily have mental illnesses. I mean, they're just, sometimes people shoot other people and they're actually quite sane. I mean, it's not something that I think most of us would do, but I mean, they, you know, there are people who, for one reason, excuse me, or another, are just bad people. So what do you do with somebody that you think is probably going to go and shoot somebody, but they're not mentally ill and they haven't committed a crime?
Captain Loudon?
Is that a problem?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. I think I understand your question. I guess where I might depart from you is there most likely would be a crime committed there. We have in our statutes a prohibited act of threatening bodily harm to people with dangerous instruments. You don't actually have to hurt them. You don't have to shoot at them and miss or those sorts of things, but there is the ability to make an arrest, to charge someone for making threats to harm other people.
Follow up?
Last one, go ahead.
So, but I assume that the threat to harm somebody is if I said on my Facebook page, for example, I'm going to shoot Representative Eastman. No offense, Representative Eastman. And Representative Eastman saw my Facebook page. So, I mean, it's a threat to somebody, like, specifically. But suppose there's this generalized statement, I don't like the world. I'm just going to go out and kill a few people. So, I mean, it's not actually a threat to anybody in particular, that anybody that they're going to shoot actually might not even see this threat. So does that like come under this statute?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think it probably would, depending on what the words were and the other actions that the person did to communicate that threat. I don't believe that it has a requirement that the threat be made against a specific person, but it's the circumstances, and I'm not trying to suggest that people do this in a light manner, but I think we all know that people have posted things on the internet that they thought were funny that weren't really funny and weren't really threats. Everybody, I think, has heard persons saying stupid things in the TSA line and getting pulled out and you know, being queried about what they said. So I don't know that the threat needs to be to a specific person, but we would have to look at the totality of the whole situation, and as we do in lots of cases, we'd have to make some judgment calls on whether or not that behavior was criminal.
So
Thank you, actually, no. Representative Lou. That was your third question, and I do want to get on to the next.
Okay,
bill.
Can I not a question? Can I make a comment here?
Yes.
Okay.
Briefly.
Appreciate your answers, Captain. But I'm wondering whether we could have somebody from the AG's office, criminal division, also answer that question.
And not today. Not at this okay. meeting, because we need to get on to the other bills. I will note for your review, if you want to look it up when we're out of session, you can look up terroristic threatening in the first degree, which is AS 11.56.807, and that may address many of the issues that he's discussing. There's also terroristic threatening in the second degree, which is 11.56.810, and those do involve issues about people making threats to others. We will hold this bill for further review.
I do have a question.
We're out of time, Representative Eastman. Our second order of business today is Senate Bill 93, Credit Report Security Freeze, sponsored by Senator Coghill. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Raniva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. Please come forward and identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your presentation. As usual, I will ask committee members to save your questions for after the presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Raniva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 93, which is a securities freeze for protected consumers. In 2016, the legislature passed a bill, Senate Bill 121, which provided one subsection in the existing statutes for security freezes for minors. What it didn't do is set up a process for creating a security freeze. So Senate Bill 93 creates that system. Section 1 is just exempting minors, or actually protected consumers, from the existing security freeze statutes on the books. First of all, you want to know what a protected consumer is, and that is an incapacitated person or a 16 younger than 16 years of age. An incapacitated person, of course, is a person who is unable to receive and evaluate information, communicate decisions, and they need assistance from someone, usually with a court order, like a legal guardian or legal representative. You ask why 16. Senate Bill 21 covered minors up to 18. However, 26 other states have reduced that to 16. And the rationale is that consumers at 16 years of age typically begin working. They own a cell phone. They have a bank account. And therefore, they have established some type of credit. So, Section 2 is the meat of the bill. This creates a system for security freeze for protected consumers. Now, a credit freeze for a minor and a credit freeze for an adult, while similar in name, in practice operate in very different ways. A credit freeze for an adult is placed to temporarily turn off the availability of an already established credit for that individual. The request could be due to identity theft, and because a credit report has previously been created by a lending agency, the credit report just needs to be frozen. The process is immediate. Because a minor does not have a credit report, a credit record must be established before the information can be frozen. So this creates the system for it. First of all, the representative must request the consumer representative would submit a request. They'd submit proof of identification of the protected consumer. That could be a birth certificate. Then they would have to provide proof of identification of the representative and a proof of authority. For instance, it could be a birth certificate and a driver's license showing that the individual on the birth certificate as the father is indeed the father. That would be proof. If it is an incapacitated person, it could be proof of authority through a court order. And then the other thing that would be required is a fee of $5. And that is because there's more to a minor than there is for an adult. It takes time to create a credit report. Things have to be verified and checked. So it could take up to 30 days to create a credit report to freeze. Again, talking about proof of identification and authority, this could be a Social Security number, certified birth certificate, driver's license, or other identification issued by a government agency. Proof of authority could be a court order or a notarized statement. As I said before, there's more involved in this credit report than with adults, where you're just freezing an existing report. And this statute says that the credit reporting agency cannot take more than 30 days to set up the credit report and put a freeze on it. The operation of the freeze is basically until the person who created the freeze requests that the freeze be lifted. Or another provision could be that security freeze was based on material representation of a misrepresentation of the fact. For instance, you could have a parent who has a birth certificate and he has proof that he is who he says he is. However, the credit reporting agency discovers later that that individual does not have legal custody of the child. In that case, they could lift the freeze. As I said, duration of the freeze could be basically as long as the person who requested it requests that it be lifted. And then when it's lifted, they have to produce the same type of information. They have to supply proof of the protected consumer, proof of the representative, and pay the agency a fee of not more than $5. And then the agency again has 30 days to remove that freeze. There is an exemption in this proposal for the $5 fee, and it includes when there is a police report filed, if there is identity theft involved, and then in Section 2 also is an exemption for entities that do not create data, but they do collect data. Most of these are government agencies. And then there are definitions at the end. Consumer credit reporting agency, a person who, for monetary fees, dues, or on a cooperative nonprofit basis, regularly engages in whole or part in practice of assembling or evaluating consumer credit information or other information on consumers for the purpose of furnishing credit reports to third parties, but does not include a person who issues the report. Section 3 is a transition section. What this section does is it says that any security freezes that are in effect when this bill becomes effective will stay in effect under the old statute. I just wanted to add that every year in the U.S., 1.3 million kids have their identity stolen.
1.3 million?
1.3 million. 50% of them are under the age of 6 years old. Thieves obtain Social Security numbers in numerous ways, but it is an industry, and 26 other states have recognized something needs to be done, and this is Alaska's attempt. to protect children and their parents from identity theft and fraud.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Moss? Representative Ledoux. And I'd ask you to go through your whole string of questions before.
No, I'm just trying to figure out. So if there is no in the first place, how do you establish a freeze on something that there isn't?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's what this bill does. It creates a process whereby the parent can go to a credit reporting agency and create a credit report to freeze. And the reason for that is if there is no credit report and no freeze, then there is no way to know that someone has taken your Social Security number and got credit cards or loans or other indebtedness in your name.
If there is no credit report.
Through the chair, that's correct.
And so, logistically, like what happens? Okay, so you freeze this credit report, and then, like, let's say somebody tries to get a credit card in the name of somebody whose credit report is frozen. Do all sorts of lights and whistles and stuff go off when...
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that sends a signal to the credit card company that there has been a freeze on this credit report, and they can probably read between the lines that someone is trying to get a credit card in that person's name and Social Security number that shouldn't have that credit.
Alon?
Nope. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. To follow up on that, through the chair. So, if I have a 2-year-old and I file for this report and freeze, and 15 years later I forgot that I did it, and my 17-year-old wants to unfreeze their credit report, and then they get all the bells and whistles because they didn't realize it was frozen to begin with, does that make it harder for that 17-year-old to go about the normal things that 17-year-olds do?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, he is now 17. He's not 16, so he has the authority to lift the freeze.
And follow up, Chair.
Representative Eastman.
So what about a 15-year-old who's trying to do those things? Does it make it hard or impossible for a 15-year-old to do some things that would otherwise be legal to do?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, with his parents' approval, they could lift the freeze. He could also, if there is a family squabble, I guess he could apply to be emancipated.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux, I'll let you have another run at it.
Okay, so that's actually where I was going. So, and maybe it's somewhere in here, but is there something which allows emancipated minors to either freeze or lift the credit freeze?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, an emancipated person is considered an adult.
Follow-up?
I'm just trying to make sure that this doesn't have a specific...
Let me see if anyone else has questions, and if not, we'll take a short at ease while you...
Okay.
Any other questions for the presenter? Let's take a brief at ease while you review your notes. Ms. Moss, you were starting to explain.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Once a person is considered an adult, they go by the provisions of state law that address freezes for adults. And that is in the same section. It starts at AS 48-100 and ends with AS 45-48-210.
So I guess I'm just sort of wondering, I see instead of, you know, an adult with a definition of adult, on page 5, I see on line 9, the protected consumer is under 16 years of age, and it doesn't have anything that he's under 16 years. I mean, it doesn't seem to be to address the emancipated minor, but I may be missing things because this is the first time I've read this.
And Representative Ledoux, I'll add a comment, and if I've got this incorrect, I'm sure Ms. Maz will get me straight. I think there's two points to remember. That credit agencies are busy collecting all our data unless we tell them not to. They're busy collecting your data and my data today from all kinds of sources, and if we decide we don't like that, we as adults send out this notice saying, put a freeze on my credit history, and then they can't research us anymore. And so, in theory, they're actively doing that for minors, even though we wish they weren't. And what this bill essentially gives individuals or families the option of saying, wait a second, I want to protect my kid. I'm going to put a freeze on their credit now, which basically says to the credit agencies, oh, we thought he was 35 or whatever they thought, and now I'm telling you this is a minor, and I don't want you collecting information on him. And so the purpose of this is to give primarily families and parents the ability to protect their youth or somebody that's disabled. And if I've got that wrong, Ms. Massa is nodding, which makes me feel much
better.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, you do have that correct, but I would, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, like to explain that once a person is emancipated, they are no longer defined as a protected consumer. They are an adult.
Thank you.
Does that answer the questions, Representative?
I think so.
Okay. And I know Ms. Moss is very available when we're done in hearing to help explain those. Representative Eastman, I'm going to...
Thank you. Through the chair.
You had your round. I'm going to give you one or two, but I want to get to the next bill. So.
I just have one question. Good. Right now. Ms. Moss, what does the bill do to handle the potentially delicate situation where mom and dad don't agree, either at the time of the two-year-old and one of them wants to freeze a report, or maybe later on when it's frozen and one of them wants to unfreeze it but the other one doesn't want to?
Through the chair, that's a good question, and there probably isn't a real clear answer. It's probably something that could end up with a judge making that decision, a support order.
Or alternatively, Representative Eastman, the $5 fee that would be charged each time at some point if parent A put a freeze on one day and then the next day parent B unfroze it for $5 and then the next day parent A refroze it and they kept going back and forth, maybe there would be a point at which the $5 would cause them to try to find a compromise. All right. I don't see any further questions, and so what I'm going to do is open up public testimony on Senate Bill 93. And I have no one online. Is there anyone in the room that wants to provide any testimony about Senate Bill 93? Hearing and seeing no one either online or in the room, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 93. At this time, we'll hold the bill for further review. And you hear from
Thank
Representative.
You,
thank you very much, Ms. Moss. You hear from Representative Millett's office. Okay. Our final order of business today is House Bill 367, Native Corporation Liability for Contamination, sponsored by Representative Millett. This is our first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is actually Representative Millett's staff, Hans Rodvik. Thank you for coming forward. Please identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your presentation. And you haven't presented here, but it is our custom that you get the full presentation before we go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Hans Rodvik, staff to Representative Millett, here to present House Bill 367, dealing with Alaska Native Corporation contaminated lands. So a brief overview of the issue. What we're dealing with here goes back a few decades, back to when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 came into law. As those lands were beginning to be conveyed to Native corporations throughout the state, folks begin to realize that there were certain lands that had been conveyed that had contamination on them prior to that conveyance. And these issues begin to be observed, and in the 1990s, the Alaska Native community began to really discuss this. And in 1998, a report by Congress, which directed the Secretary of the Interior, took a look at the issue. And what that report found was that there were some 650 contaminated sites were known to have been conveyed to Alaska Native corporations under ANCSA. The outcome of that report Unfortunately, didn't produce much other than it surveyed the issue well, but no action was really taken. So about a decade went by, and in 2014, Congress mandated the Department of Interior to update that inventory of contaminated lands. And in 2016, DOI completed a report, and it again found some 500-plus sites that needed remediation and cleanup and to truly resolve the issue. The largest party of those pre-transferred lands that were contaminated was found to be the Department of Defense. So what has come out of the 2016 report and work with organizations like the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association is this bill, and also a bill at the federal level. And so what House Bill 367 will do is it's not going to solve the problem of cleaning up the lands, but it will help bring Alaska Native corporations into a place where they're able to actually begin addressing these matters. We'll probably have some folks on the line who can testify to that. But essentially what we're trying to do is take liability away from Alaska Native corporations who were transferred lands that were contaminated, and they did not know about those contaminations while the conveyance was occurring. And what the issue is that under current state law, they would be liable for the cleanup, for the cost, for the damages that might come from those contaminated lands. So we've brought House Bill 367 forward to remove that level of liability.
Thank you very much. We'll do one round of questions for each of us, and then we'll open the public testimony. Representative Ledoux.
So I'm really sympathetic to this, but I'm wondering why it is strictly limited to Native corporation lands. Because, I mean, our state has these strict liability laws so that somebody can be, like, totally and completely innocent and something has been conveyed to them and they have absolutely no idea that there is, you know, a contaminant on it. So, I mean, it kind of seems to me that if we're going to do it, you know, for one category of folks, maybe we should just, you know, revisit the entire law.
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was a pretty monumental piece of legislation in Alaska's history. We're talking 44 million acres of conveyed lands. Many of these corporations, it's not just the regional corps who are affected with contaminated lands. It's many village and smaller corporations who, under the current liability statutes of the state, could be honestly decimated if they came forward and had to be found liable and had to deal with those with the contamination. You know, it's a conversation that may be had to look at other parties that are responsible for contamination, but the scope of the bill is just focused on Alaska Native corporations.
So how would it
follow up?
So how would it work under this bill? So let's say a Native corporation had conveyed land that they'd gotten through ANCSTA, and then they'd conveyed it to someone else, and or some of the land, and the someone else that they conveyed it to, I mean, they found that the land was contaminated. Would this also immunize whoever the land was conveyed to?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that's a question I'm going to have to get back to you on in terms of passing Native corporations passing on lands or selling off lands or conveying it to other parties, if that new party would be relieved from liability. I think the point of what we're trying to do here is focus on the corporations who have contamination on their lands, want to clean it up, want to help remediate these environmental disasters, and get back to a place where their lands are remediated and taken care of, and they can move forward with their communities, whether it be through responsible resource development or just use of their lands. But in terms of passing it on, I'd have to get some more legal opinions on that.
I'd actually like to know what happens, if you could get that for me. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So, through the chair, when was the last land grant under ANCSA?
Representative Eastman, I would have to do some research on that.
All right. And follow up then.
Representative Eastman.
So, whenever that last grant of land was, can you tell us, are there any circumstances or situations where Native Corporation or someone else would be either in possession or control or have some administrative responsibilities over land prior to it actually formally and officially and legally being granted to them? It would seem to me that that might be the case, and if it is, maybe rather than having the immunization start or the trigger be when the land was granted, maybe a more appropriate trigger would be when the person who received the land grant, came to possess or control or administer or manage the land. See what I'm saying?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the process of conveying lands under ANCSA, I think it's actually still ongoing. There's still land that has not been fully conveyed to Alaska Native corporations by particular parties. In terms of the word grant versus convey, I think we had some discussion of that in the Resources Committee, and that might be something that we could take a look at. If that is what you're considering in terms of the actual time, the time frame for the removal of liability?
So to clarify, what I'm asking is whether the last three words of the bill are appropriate and are meeting the intent, because if we're only dealing with at the time the land was granted, and as you said, there's land that hasn't even been granted yet and may be granted in the future, maybe it's not right to absolve someone of responsibility because they haven't been granted the land yet, if they're the ones who may already be aware or maybe even have contributed to some type of contaminants or something like that. If they're responsible in some way, I don't know that what we're trying to do is remove them from liability just because they haven't been granted the land yet. See what I'm saying?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think it comes back to the difference of the definition of granted and conveyed. I think the lands were granted to Alaska Native corporations under ANCSA, but they have not yet, certain lands have not yet been conveyed. And those lands that are granted, the ones that had contamination before they were actually conveyed, those are the ones that we want to remove liability from. The language that's in this bill worked in conjunction with the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. I think they can possibly better speak to the issue of why they thought that language was best suited.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see anyone else with questions as to the bill sponsor. So that will bring us to invited testimony. The one person we have on the phone for invited testimony is Hallie Bissett from the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. Ms. Bissett, I just note if you have some, we'll take some testimony from you. I'll give you a little more time since I know your organization is particularly interested in the bill. But if you could identify yourself for the record, please make sure you're on a handset and not on a speakerphone, and identify yourself before you start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Hallie Bissett. I am the Executive Director for Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. First of all, I'd like to say Chinan Guninyo, thank you very much for being here today, Mr. Chairman and the rest of the committee members, and for hearing our testimony on this bill. As I said, my name is Hallie Bissett. I'm the granddaughter of Talkeetna Nikolai, who was the last traditional chief of Sunshine Village, or what is now known as Talkeetna. I thank you once again for allowing me the opportunity to provide an Alaska Native Corporation perspective on the status of contaminated lands. I have served on the board of directors for Cook Inlet Region Incorporated since 2010, and so I'm very aware of the various contaminated sites that we have, one being right in between the two major population centers of Anchorage and the Mat-Su, with Camp Mohawk out in Aklutna, which is currently contaminating the Cook Inlet with PCBs. So it's a very real problem. It's right in our backyard, and we can't ignore it any longer. As was already mentioned, in 1971, Congress passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act into law on December 18, 1971. And on that day, the federal government agreed to convey 12 Alaska Regional Native Corporations and more than 200 village corporations, 44 million acres of land. And to be clear, Alaska Native people gave up 88% of their traditional lands through this settlement. Congress directed the Department of Interior to oversee the transfer of these lands. It wasn't until the late 80s that we realized that they were, in fact, transferring contaminated lands. And that wasn't land that we knew was contaminated, so the federal government wasn't handing over the documentation letting us know what was out there. And what is out there? We're talking about arsenic, unexploded ordnances, PCBs, among many other things. I would like to address Representative Ledoux's comment about why is this limited to ANCSA corporations. I believe it's limited to ANCSA corporations for the very fact that we gave up 88% of our traditional lands in exchange for this settlement, and that we were supposed to get economically viable lands in exchange, not lands that we were legally liable to clean up. And so I think there's a huge disservice that was done to our people when that happened over these many years. And so we are trying to remedy the situation. We are trying to get the legal liability shield in place so that we can complete the inventory of the total sites that are out there. As is noted in the report, we're looking at about 650 right now, but there's about 100 more that need to be evaluated for what's exactly there. Now, if this had happened 20 or 30 times, I might think that it was a mistake, but this happened over 900 times. And so I think that we really need to do something about this. Since I've been working on this project, I've met people that on one side of the river, their people are dying of a certain type of cancer, and on the other they are not. I have met people that are hanging glow-in-the-dark fish up at their fish camp. And so I've got people in Unalakleet that believe they're getting Parkinson's from all of the PCBs that are dumping into their water. And so this is a very real problem, and we would like to clean it up. Of the report that identifies 94 orphan sites. What does orphan site mean? An orphan site means they have no intention to clean it up.
And Ms. Bissett, you've gone a little past the 3 minute. If you could go ahead and conclude your remarks, and I suspect there may be some questions from members of the committee.
Absolutely. Just want to conclude by saying we thank you for hearing us out. We'd love to get this legal liability shield in place so that we can start work on cleaning up these lands. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Bissett. Mr. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Well, I appreciate the desire to clean up these lands. I do have a question, though, in terms of how this bill helps lands be cleaned up, in that I think what I gather from the bill is that it is absolving liability, at least in some situations, from corporations. And I don't know how that helps the owners of the land to clean it up. If anything, doesn't that sort of make it so that you don't have to clean it up? It's not your fault?
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Through the chair, it's a great question. And one of the things that we're going for here is because we are potentially responsible parties, that's the term they use in the CERCLA federal law, we are unable to apply for instance, EPA brownfield development grants. And so that's one of the reasons why we're doing this. We need to lift the liability problem for us so that we can get access to federal funds for cleanup.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Bissett? I don't see any other questions. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony on House Bill 367. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to provide testimony on House Bill 367? Seeing no one in the room, the only other person online is Kristen Ryan, who is here from the Spill Prevention and Response, who is here to answer questions but is not here to provide public testimony. So hearing and seeing no one that wants to provide public testimony, the public testimony on House Bill 367 is now closed. Any other questions for the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside for the day? Hearing and seeing none, I want to take a brief at ease and come back as soon as possible. I predict less than 5 minutes. Back on record, we're going to stay at ease until 2:45, at which point I'm optimistic that that Deputy Attorney General Rob Henderson will be able to come here, because he's apparently in Juneau today, and answer Representative Ledoux's questions. So we're at ease until 2:45, and ask you all to please come back promptly so we don't have to run after 3. Thank you, and we'll be back at ease. We're back on record. In House Judiciary, we're going to return to House Bill 75. Representative Ledoux, you had asked we get a representative from the Attorney General's office to answer some of the questions you had raised related to what happens when, the broad terms of the questions were, somebody's posted on something on Facebook that they're really angry, they're upset, they want to do some serious damage, they want to go to a school and shoot some folks, and they are somebody that, for purposes of this question, they wouldn't be able to be institutionalized under Title 47. There would be no basis to hold them. They're just angry. And so if you could come forward and explain what options the police or the troopers would have, what crimes they might be able to arrest somebody for in that setting. And if I got the question wrong, Representative...
Yeah, no, I think you have the question right.
And this is Casey Schroeder from the Attorney General's office, and she'll say that too, but I'm getting Ben tuned in.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. There are several statutes that we can look at when dealing with somebody making threatening types of statements. There's assault, first of all. So if somebody makes, by words or other conduct, is threatening to somebody, it could potentially be a fear assault. That would be an assault in the fourth degree. It could be the harassment in the second degree, and that would probably be most directly applicable to the hypothetical that the chairman has talked about, somebody posting something online about perhaps shooting up a school or doing other damage. And I can tell you that we have prosecuted somebody fairly recently for doing something like that, where a person posted on another's Facebook page, and this statement was, "You're going to get assassinated." And that was prosecuted under the harassment in the second degree statute. So we have something fairly recent to look to.
Follow-up, Representative. Okay. Actually, it's your question. You're not following up yet.
Okay. But that is where they've posted on somebody's Facebook page, "Hey, I'm going to assassinate you." But I guess I'm talking about a more generalized. Doesn't name the school, just says, "Hey, you know, I'm really mad at the world. I think I'm going to go and blow up some people."
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we would look at that on a sliding scale type of analysis. So the more generalized the statement is, the harder it would be for us to prosecute as a crime. The more specific it is and more imminent it reads to be, the better chance we have of prosecuting it as a crime.
So, follow-up? Under my example, you wouldn't do anything?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think the statement you just gave me is very general. That's not to say that we wouldn't do anything. We may use that as a reason to start an investigation to see if they're doing something, to take further steps in furtherance of the statement. I would just bring it back to the school situation. If somebody's talking about a school situation and it is a student, schools also can take steps such as suspensions and things like that that are short of criminal actions. So there's a wide range of things that can be done short of criminal actions when somebody's making threatening statements.
No, and I'm not, when I say you wouldn't do anything, that's not meant as a criticism. I'm just trying to figure out whether we need this bill or whether or not under our current statutes, when somebody says, "Hey, I'm really, really angry, I am going to go and murder 10 people." And so under our current statutes, if somebody said something like that, can you arrest them and take their weapons away?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think based on that statement alone, if there was nothing else, and I think that would be difficult to prosecute.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Schroeder? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder, through the chair. So in looking at this bill, we have a situation where weapons could be taken away. So if they are taken away, I'm trying to kind of follow through that whole process. So they're taken away. You know, what happens if the individual who owns the weapons dies while those weapons are taken away? What happens to the weapons in that kind of situation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I guess I don't know. I haven't thought through the death of this of somebody, and I think that gets into disposal of property. I haven't looked at that.
Sounds like an estate matter to me. I see no other questions, so thank you very much for coming on relatively short notice. I appreciate your coming, and I actually do want to note it's not a question, but I had earlier identified the terroristic threatening statutes, and the terroristic threatening statute, I had been familiar with it from the early 1990s when I was involved in a criminal case involving somebody charged with terroristic threatening, and after a conversation with Ms. Schroeder about the current version of the terroristic threatening statute, I realized that the particular case in which I was involved where the defendant was actually calling on the phone and calling another person and taking his pen, apparently, and clicking it by the phone to make it sound like a gun being opened or closed, that was prosecuted as terroristic threatening for the direct threat by words or conduct, and under the modern the more recent changes to the terroristic threatening statute, that would not be charged or could not be charged today as terroristic threatening. So I'm not quite sure how much terroristic threatening would have implication in a school shooting type hypothetical today. It doesn't require a response from Ms. Schroeder, but I just want to note that the statute has been updated since I seem to know the statute better. And that's all we're going to hear on House Bill 75 today. We will adjourn this meeting. Our next meeting had been scheduled for 7 o'clock tonight, but due to both the illness of one of our members as well as the process about getting amendments drafted, I'm going to cancel tonight's meeting. LegLegal has contacted my office about the workload to complete the proposed amendments to House Bill 75. So at this point, I'm expecting that I will extend the deadline to submit those amendments by email to later than 4 o'clock today. They'll still be due today. And to be accepted after 4 o'clock, you'll be required to show that your office made a reasonable and timely request to LegLegal in light of the current 4 p.m. deadline for us to accept any amendment that comes in after 4. We'll send out by email the new deadline for submitting them this evening. But we are canceling the meeting for tonight, and the amendments will still be due at a later hour today. But Representative Reinbold, you weren't here when I said it, but I'll say it again. All right. I will be extending it to a time we'll send out by email, but if it's coming in after 4, you're going to have to make a showing that you made a reasonable and timely request to LegLegal for that amendment. Sending at 5-4 to LegLegal isn't going to cut it. And if anyone is considering an amendment to Senate Bill 93, Credit Report Security Freeze, sponsored by Senator Coghill, please let my office know and submit any amendment by email by 4 p.m. Thursday. That's tomorrow. And my goal is to take up all amendments to Senate Bill 93 at our meeting on Friday. With that, we'll stand adjourned.
Can I say something real quick about the amendment?
Which amendment?
The amendment for 75. That's what I was doing. I was trying to
work that.
At 11 a.m. I had all but one amendment. The second, the last one was at 2.
We'll just see. You know, I will see what you can show us. Best to get them in by 4. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is 2:59 p.m.